Greetings, everybody. This is the 29th day of July 2021, so we are told. I want to make an announcement that normally we do our gatherings every 2 weeks. Next gathering will be on the 19th day of August 2021, 3 weeks from today, not our typical two-week schedule. Greetings to everybody out there from the House of Prayer. This is Daniel. The House of Prayer call is a call where we explore our liberty and our options with a mission statement from Isaiah 58:6, which is the chosen fast, which for those of you that don't know Isaiah 58:6, I recite it every call we have, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. With that in mind, tonight we are going to give an ear to Joan Priestley, MD. And she's a medical doctor that graduated from the University of Michigan in 1979. She started a holistic practice soon thereafter in 1980. She basically was studying that the herbs that people were taking would seem to help them more than pharmaceutical industry medicines, and began to explore the quote-unquote green pharmacy. In 1982, she started working with AIDS patients, and for the most part, she spent a lot of her adult practice, her continuing practice, dealing with immune-compromised patients for the rest of her career. So tonight, we're going to give her an ear. She's going to share with us about this COVID situation from a medical doctor's perspective. Joan, I hope I didn't goof that up too bad, and you can fill in the gaps if I miss something. Very much welcome to you. Welcome to the House of Prayer call.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you very much. I want to tell everyone what an honor and a pleasure it is to talk here today. I've been a friend of John Harpel's for decades at this point, and he's informed me a little bit about what you folks are doing. And I really stand in awe of the work that this group is accomplishing. And I want to impart some information today about an issue that is going to affect every single one of us sooner or later. So I'd like to start with just a bit about my professional history, because I'm really just a disembodied voice here, and I'd like you to know more about how I came to be where I am now. I did start a holistic medicine practice almost as soon as I graduated from medical school in 1980, and I made a commitment that I was going to find something that was not a drug that I would be able to use instead of drugs to treat patients. And I started a practice in Key West, Florida, of all places, back then. It was the southernmost tip of America. I didn't know that at the time, but Key West was somewhat of a gay paradise. And some of the people who were very early on infected with what came to be called HIV or AIDS came to see me. They wanted some other options. Actually, at that point, they wanted any options, because this was before the very first drug called AZT, or azathioprine, had been developed. So doctors were telling their patients who were 26 years old, go home and die and get your affairs in order. So they didn't do that. They came to see me instead. And I developed a non-drug program to treat HIV. I had really such excellent success that I went to Los Angeles to expand my practice and treat more HIV-positive people and do my best to make other doctors aware of this alternative option. So I was really in on the ground floor of AIDS. You've heard of the movie The Dallas Buyers Club, which is an excellent film, largely true, that one fellow who was an electrician did start the Dallas Buyers Club and did do just about everything that's featured in this film. Well, that was not the only Buyers Club. There was a Los Angeles Buyers Club also, and I was sort of a deep throat advisor to that Buyers Club. And they were going to Mexico and contracting with Mexican drug companies to create drugs and smuggling them back into Los Angeles. Those guys were astounding. I was thrilled to be part of their operation. But the major players who ran that show were Tony Fauci, Deborah Birx, and Robert Redfern. And back then, in about 1990 or so, they used the same playbook: fraudulent research, changing the definitions, moving the goalposts. They developed useless tests for diagnosis, and they pushed dangerous and useless drugs and repeatedly reversed their recommendations. So we fast forward some 30 years later. Lo and behold, it's the same players, and they're doling out the same playbook, but on steroids this time. So I had a reference point that few other people have enjoyed, because this was not my first rodeo. I had watched those same people in action in the first go-around when they botched the AIDS management. So I want to start and end with the two most outrageous frauds of this pandemic. But first, I'd just like to decipher some terminology for you, because there are a lot of three- and four-letter acronyms. An acronym is something where the first letter of a number of words are bunched together to create sort of a super word, like scuba, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. But who knows that? We just call it scuba gear. So there's SARS-2, which is severe acute respiratory syndrome number 2. Why is it number 2? Because there was SARS, which has now become SARS-1 a number of years ago. And then there's COVID-19. COVID stands for coronavirus infectious disease. 19 because we became aware of it in 2019. Now that is the infection. SARS-2 is the virus, but people confuse the two a lot. The next term is PCR, which is the only test that's used for determining someone's virus status, and that stands for polymerase chain reaction. EUA means emergency use authorization, which is conferred by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. We talk about IFR, which is the infection fatality rate. That is, you simply take the total number of infections and divide it by the total number of deaths, and we get an infection fatality rate. Then there is the case fatality rate, which is different. The total number of infections until this pandemic was always considered to be larger than the total number of cases, because cases were by definition people who had symptoms. You had to be symptomatic to be declared a case. If you were asymptomatic, you were really an infection. So CFR is the case fatality rate. Then we compare the RRR to the ARR. And that is sufficiently important that I typed up a handout for everyone on that. RRR is the relative risk reduction, and the ARR is the absolute risk reduction. I'm not going to confuse people by talking more about that right now, because you have a several page handout that deciphers it for you, I hope, anyway. So the first most outrageous aspect of this whole situation is the PCR test. Some people have said, we don't have a COVID pandemic, we have a PCR pandemic, and we could end this COVID pandemic by ending the PCR pandemic, or at least admitting what's true and what's not true about this test. So what is the PCR test? It is run by using hot and cold sequences, one hot cold sequence is one cycle. Each cycle amplifies the detection of the material being tested. More cycles need less material to test positive. But how much less? Each cycle doubles the amplification of particles. So for those who are mathematically inclined, this would be written 2 to the nth power, where n is the number of cycles used. So let's look at one cycle versus 10 cycles, which would be written 2 to the 10th power. So the first cycle would be 2. You multiply it times 2 to get 4. Times 2 is 8. Times 2 is 16. And then 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, and 1024. But it's actually in reverse. So if it takes 1024 particles to register positive by running one cycle, you would divide by 2. To run it at 2 cycles, you only need 512 particles. Divide by 2. To run it at 3 cycles, you only need 256 particles. And so it goes. So by the 10th cycle, what required 1,024 particles to run at one cycle needs only two miserable, lousy particles to test positive when you run it at 10 cycles. This causes a number of problems. Number one, this is a qualitative test. It's merely a yes, no, positive or negative. It doesn't even have any gray areas, like some other tests will come back weakly positive. This one doesn't have any room for that. It's just positive or negative. But there's no quantitative viral load being measured. And the inventor, who named Carey Mullis, who received the Nobel Prize for his effort, said over and over, as loudly and on as often as he could, this test was never meant to be diagnostic. It is not capable of being a diagnostic test. Nonetheless, that's what we have for diagnosis. So people will talk about confirmed cases using the PCR test. That is laughable. There is no such thing as a confirmed case with a PCR because there is no reference standard that's run for any comparison. So the PCR needs a confirmatory test, and we don't have it. In addition, I am convinced, although the labs have been very cagey when I talk to them, that they're not running samples independently. They're not running each person's swab separately. In other words, they're running them in batches. And so whatever comes out the weakest positive test, all those samples in that batch are labeled positive. But I can't verify that for sure. It's just my suspicion. Because of the sheer number of tests that are being run every single day, it's just not physically possible to clean the machine, add the reagents, run a test, calibrate it, clean the machine, add the reagents, run a test. It would take weeks to do what they're cranking out in days. So the second problem with the PCR test is that it only measures tiny fragments of amino acid sequences. So it cannot differentiate between inactive viral debris and intact live infectious virus. So for someone who's not symptomatic to go and get this test, it's absolutely useless. It tells us absolutely nothing. But if it's positive, they're labeled a case, a confirmed case. I mean, I hope you can understand, this is ludicrous. So anyone who's been previously infected, which simply means they had an earlier positive PCR test, for whatever that means, the fragments last for months. So they do their civic duty, and they go and get retested, and lo and behold, it's positive. Is this a new case? No. It's simply dead fragments left over from their last infection. But there's no way to differentiate that. So they're labeled a new case and reported to the health department as another case. So the third problem with the PCR test is that it is not specific for SARS-2. Other coronaviruses causing a present infection or a previous infection will cross-react and produce a false positive. In addition, the influenza virus cross-reacts, whether it's a real infection from the flu or a debris that is circulating in someone's body from getting a flu shot. So this constant calling to get your flu shot, all it's going to do is create more people in the population who did not have any circulating flu virus particles or fragments of sequences in their body, but because they got the flu shot, now they do. And they go out and get a PCR test, and they test positive. And it's a false positive from cross-reaction from the ingredients in the flu shot. The CDC has finally, the Centers for Disease Control, has finally acknowledged this, and they're actually going to discontinue the use of the PCR test on January 1st of 2022, precisely because it includes cases that are actually influenza. You know, they're finally acknowledging what was obvious from the start. Now, this is going to lead to an interesting situation because they are leaving it up to individual labs to choose one of a number of FDA-approved tests that are still in the experimental stage. The new tests are not really approved. They're just going to be authorized for emergency use. So we're not even going to know what tests an individual lab uses when they start reporting. But from now until January 1st, we're still stuck with this PCR test with all of its flaws and limitations. Well, the result of all this is that the positives that are coming out from the PCR test are completely dependent on the number of cycles used. Even Fauci has admitted that when the over 35 cycles are used, it's very hard to obtain a true positive, that there's so many false positives that are registered when it's 35 or more cycles. It's been estimated that the false positive rate of 40 cycles is 90%. In other words, of every 10 positive PCR tests, only one person actually has a SARS-2 infection. But the CDC has recommended that labs use 40 to 45 cycles, which guarantees more than 90% false positives. From various countries, people have sent in mangoes, Coca-Cola, other products, even water. They all test positive at 40 or more cycles. Now, except for Florida, laboratories do not have to report the number of cycles that they use on a specimen. So you have no idea whether it was 25 cycles, 35 cycles, or 45 cycles. So area-wide testing of the general healthy asymptomatic public will just produce even more false positives. And all this does is increase the number count, which the media then hawks to the public, and it just creates more panic in the populace. So this test then is very open to manipulation by changing the number of cycles. We can ramp up, tamp down, explode, or eliminate this pandemic solely by changing the number of cycles that are used to run this test. And the CDC understands this. I actually personally call it the center of deceitful charlatans. And this is why. They're now telling hospitals and labs that if someone has been vaccinated, the PCR test must be run at 24 cycles. But if they're not vaccinated, the PCR test is run anywhere between 35 and 40 cycles. That means that the unvaccinated are far, far more likely to show a positive PCR test, false or true positive, than anyone who's been vaccinated. This tilts the numbers to make it appear that people who've been vaccinated are safe from this virus. That's not the case at all. All they're doing, the CDC is doing, is running a huge lower number of cycles. So the CDC has also stopped reporting outbreaks in the vaccinated unless they're in a hospital or dead. So anyone who tests positive, even at 24 cycles, and has a very mild infection or asymptomatic infection, well, the CDC just throws those away, and they're not reporting them. This also tilts the number artificially to make it appear as though unvaccinated people are much more likely to get COVID infections. So they will report vaccinated people who are in the hospital, except that. They've now advised the hospital to stop running PCR tests on vaccinated people who were admitted to the hospital. So there's no COVID test run, so there's no diagnosis of COVID on their admission certificates or their death certificates. This just further skews the apparent results to make it appear that only the unvaccinated are getting this infection and are getting sick from this infection. So we're going to leave the PCR test now and just talk about the general manipulation of statistics that has gone on from day one with this pandemic. The first one is fraud in counting cases. We will never know the real incidence of SARS-2 infections. because doctors have been counting what we call presumptive cases. And that means someone who shows up with a couple of symptoms and the doctor says, oh, well, it must be COVID. Why run a test? It must be COVID. So they just have symptoms with no diagnostic test. So another way that fraud has been committed in counting cases that I discovered is that one case can become 16 with contact tracers. So what happens, at least in Alaska, is that a person tests positive, their information goes to a contact tracer who calls them up and says, well, did you go out in the last month? Well, who didn't, unless you're you know, paralyzed in a bed? Who didn't go outside? Did you go to a store? Did you go to a theater? Did you go to the library? Did you do anything? Did you even go outside? So, oh, of course we did. So the contact tracer makes it up, because this is what they're told to do, that person with a positive PCR test must have infected at least 15 others during the course of their travels. So they are told to report that as one confirmed case and 15 presumptive cases. So they dutifully send those numbers in to their state public health department, which dutifully sends those numbers on to the CDC, and the CDC, frankly, launders them. The CDC combines presumptive and confirmed cases and comes up with one number that they announce every week. This is not the first time they've done that. They're always aware that they've been doing that with influenza and pneumonia forever. So if I said to this group or anybody, how many people died of flu last year? It's an almost automatic knee-jerk reaction. Oh, 36,000. Every year, 36,000 people die of the flu. How many times have we heard that? Well, one year, some people sent in a Freedom of Information Act request that said, it's really influenza and pneumonia. We'd like to know how many people died of bacterial pneumonia and how many people died of influenza, which, of course, is a viral infection. And the answer came back, well, 35,000, something like 920 died of pneumonia and 80 died of influenza. But the numbers are conflated together and expanded, mainly to scare people, I think. It makes an awful lot of people take their flu shots every year. Another way there's fraud in counting cases is that hospitals have tremendous financial incentives to mislabel incoming patients as COVID cases. They get, for a case of pneumonia, there's a flat Medicare payment of $3,900, I believe it is, whereas if it's COVID pneumonia, the hospital gets $13,000 and change. So there's tremendous incentivized desire to put pressure on the doctors. And doctors have been posting little snippets all over the Internet that reporting how they've been pressured to do just that. So the symptoms, at first it was cough, fever, and shortness of breath. The symptoms keep expanding. Now it's headache, fatigue, nausea, diarrhea, muscle aches, of course, loss of sense of smell or taste. So somebody comes in to see somebody, comes into an ER, especially if they have diarrhea and nausea. Oh, well, that's a COVID symptom. We should label this a COVID infection. And that is exactly what's happening, what's been happening since the start of this epidemic. The other issue is people who are dying with COVID or of COVID, well, to say due to COVID. Now, a lot of people are in the hospital for other reasons, and they've either had a positive PCR test within the last 28 days, or they've got symptoms consistent with a COVID infection, which are, of course, consistent with 100 other problems. And they die, and they are considered to have died of COVID. But that's not true at all. They simply had a positive PCR test at some point, or were presumptive because they simply had a couple of symptoms that are now considered consistent with COVID. Of COVID means they had a COVID infection and it killed them. So the CDC recently admitted that only 6% of the deaths they have reported were of COVID or due to COVID. So you hear this figure bandied around about how 600,000 people have died. Well, 94% of them died of other causes, and they happen to have a positive PCR test, or they happen to have a couple of symptoms that were considered consistent with COVID. So that's some of the highlights of the fraud that's going on in counting cases. The next section is fraud in counting deaths. Now, the CDC has changed the way death certificate methods are used only for COVID infections. So if someone even is a presumed COVID case and has other much more serious problems that ultimately resulted in their demise, the doctors are supposed to put COVID on the death certificate and then list the other cases secondarily. Even with presumptive cases, with no PCR test, they're listed as COVID deaths. You've probably heard about some of the other really outlandish deaths that were listed as COVID. People who were murdered by gunshot, fell from a ladder, were involved in a fatal motorcycle crash or car crash, people who killed themselves. If that event happened within 28 days of a positive PCR test, or again, even with no PCR test, but just a history of some of these nonspecific symptoms, they're listed and sent to the CDC as a COVID death. And the hospitals, I am told, have an enormous financial incentive to mislabel deaths as COVID. They probably get more money still for doing that. So, what is the real virulence, which is to say aggressiveness and lethality of this virus? This all started with a report from the Imperial College in England, headed by Neil Ferguson and funded in large measure by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They projected 3.6% death rate. They would not release their methodology. They would not release anything about this number. It's just, hey, trust us, we're scientists. 3.6% of the people who get this infection are going to die, which they labeled as in the millions. And it was this report that started the worldwide panic and irrational lockdowns. But the reality is, and I would refer you to the two charts that I included, just as you folks know how you can use someone's own laws against them, I found that you can use their own charts against them. So the first chart that I sent you is it was a screenshot that I took on just last Tuesday for the state of Alaska, the entire state. And the total cases since February of 2020 were 71,286. The total deaths since February 2020 were 377. So if you divide 377 by 71,286, you arrive at a case fatality ratio of 0.0052, which is 0.5%. And that's total since this infection started over, 18 months ago. So the overall survival rate in Alaska, which really parallels the overall survival rate nationally, is 99.48%. Now, this is overall. It doesn't stratify for age or for other medical problems or for anything else. This is just looking at everyone who had this positive PCR test versus everyone who died, 99.48% survival rate. The second chart that I passed out, and I do apologize if anyone's on this call who didn't get those, just listen politely for a few minutes. The second chart is labeled Table 2 COVID-19 cases by age. And the date is April 9th, 2021. This is locally. This is from our Anchorage Public Health Department, which has stopped posting these charts because too many people like me were reading them. So, but in April, precious few people had received a vaccination here in Alaska. So this is really the unvaccinated data. So, and again, the deaths, there were only 28,493 cases at that time. That's the second column, all cases, all time. The deaths were 52 total, and that's a 0.5% death rate once again. If you look at the numbers carefully and break it down by age group, generally for everyone who is less than under 60 years old, they accounted for only 15% of the deaths, but 85% of all infections. Conversely, anyone who was over 60, it was the opposite. They were only 15% of the infections, but 85% of the deaths. So there's kind of a linear relationship between age and a risk of dying. So the final column over on the right is death rates per 100 cases, and that's a real percentage case. So for the age range, 50 to 59, 0.3%. Actually, they show 0.4, but when I calculated it, it was 0.3. That's one-third of 1%. Age 60 to 69, 1.2% death rate. 70 to 79, it climbs, 5.5% death rate. Over 80, 11% death rate. So that means roughly a little bit more than 1 in 10 of people who are over 80 who get this infection will succumb to it. So we've had a lot of months to figure out some of the risk factors. It's called the epidemiology stratification. It's the big word they attach to it. I call it the O's because the O's have it. So people who are older, as we've seen, COVID infections have a great relationship to increasing age. People who are overweight, especially those who are really fat, and I think that's because obesity promotes chronic low-level inflammation. So it's when the virus comes along, it's easier to ramp up chronic low-level inflammation into overwhelming inflammation than it is to develop inflammation in someone who is not overweight and doesn't have chronic continuing inflammation in the background. The third O is just my miscellaneous category, other underlying problems. And that includes specifically heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, kidney disease, lung disease, any kind of cancer, but especially blood cancers like leukemias, anyone who's bedridden, which means they're indoors constantly, they're not getting great food most likely, and no exercise. Anyone who has an organ transplant, anyone who has any immune deficiency, or any kind of autoimmune disease. Anyone who is black, really just with darker skin, or has sickle cell anemia, few people know that blood type A is a risk factor for COVID infection or more severe COVID infection, and especially just about anyone and everyone who is vitamin D deficient, and that is a large part of our population, that vitamin D levels might be responsible for the seasonality of this virus and a lot of other viruses, especially influenza. People are out in swimsuits in the summertime, getting sunshine all day long. Their vitamin D skyrockets, and it protects them from viral infections. Wintertime comes, we bundle up, we stay indoors, vitamin D levels plummet, and that's when we see the emergence of a lot of these infections. So let's talk about personal protection measures. The first one is masks. This is like putting up a chain link fence to protect yourself from mosquitoes, really. All you need to do is look up on the internet, look up the mask demonstration by Ted Noel, who's a MD anesthesiologist. I tell people this all the time. Just Google Ted Noel. Think of Christmas, N-O-E-L. And that seems to be enough of a tickler that people remember it and they'll do it. The 3-minute presentation about masks that is absolutely hilarious, and it just gives a lie about protection from masks. They, in a word, that masks don't do squat against viruses. The virus is just so small that it can just pass through even the N95s. I mean, they're called 95 because that mask, which has to be fitted to one's face. You don't just pick up an N95 mask at the drugstore and waltz off with it. But the virus is far too small. The 95 in N95 means its pores are so tiny that it will trap 95% of even viruses coming through, but there's still that 5%. So in the May 20th of 2020, in the New England Journal of Medicine, they actually ran an article that looked critically at mask protection. And the summary of that article was, and I quote from the article, "The only thing whose transmission is decreased by the healthy population continuously wearing masks is anxiety. They do nothing to protect people against this virus, either from contracting it or from spreading it." Is that the only study? No. There was a Danish mask study recently. They had to go through something like 4 journals to find one that would dare publish it. But they found that the risk reduction by a population wearing masks for 6 months was 0.5% protection. The CDC also did a study that showed, again, less than 1% reduction in infections with constant use of masking. The other problem is, I people watch all the time here in Anchorage, now that we can go outside again, and there's not one person in 100 that knows how to wear these masks properly or use them properly. And if you're wearing them incorrectly, for instance, just I ask somebody all the time, "Sorry, I can't hear you. What did you say?" And they reach their hand over the mask and pull it down to talk to me and then pull it back up again. Well, they've just contaminated their mask. They're supposed to throw that mask out and use another one. Do they? Of course not. They have no idea how to use masks. We have a lot of manly Alaska men up here with bushy beards. What a joke. These masks are absolutely useless with beards. I told our assembly, if you're going to tell people how to use masks correctly and mandate them, you best mandate that every man shave his beard as well. Otherwise, this is absolutely useless. Whatever. The CDC just flipped again on masks. Now they're recommending universal masking indoors, whether you're vaccinated or not, which kind of gives the lie to the protection that vaccines confer, but I'll talk about that later. Masks definitely do have adverse effects. They've been shown to increase the carbon dioxide gradually in people's lungs, because it's really hard to exhale through these masks. Conversely, it's a little bit more difficult to get oxygen into your lungs. So we have a nasty combination of increased carbon dioxide and decreased oxygen. The masks can also trap bacteria, which can then be re-inhaled. People have reported headaches, nausea, fatigue, decreased concentration, poor judgment, fainting, just keeling over from lack of oxygen and increased carbon dioxide. There is another thought that anyone who's had cancer should not be wearing these masks because the increased carbon dioxide creates an environment that cancer cells love, and the decreased oxygen, cancers just love an environment that has less oxygen. It encourages their growth. What about wearing masks indoors? Well, remember, they don't do anything indoors or outdoors. It's been estimated that it takes 10 to 30 minutes of close, constant contact for any transmission. So you're not going to get or transmit this infection to someone you just passed by in a supermarket. That just doesn't happen. What about wearing masks outdoors? Well, I mustered myself down to the assembly and told them that it is ludicrous. It is beyond fact-free, science-free. It is ludicrous to impose any kind of mask mandate outdoors. The ultraviolet light from sunlight kills this virus and a lot of other viruses in seconds. It's just crazy to wear masks outdoors. Children wearing masks, I think, is clear-cut child abuse. I'm just personally horrified that schools are mandating that little children wear these masks all day long because they have the same problems with increased carbon dioxide and decreased oxygen that makes them less able to think clearly, concentrate, focus, learn well, and yet we're doing it all across the country. Now, an alternative to masks is face shields, which is just a piece of plastic another piece of plastic that comes across your forehead, and they extend downward. They don't They don't touch your face. They don't create a barrier. I mean, it's just plain stupid to have people wear face shields, but you see it all the time. So the next personal protective measure is stand 6 feet apart, which I call antisocial distancing. Where do we get 6 feet? The CDC just drew it out of a hat or out of their ass. It's a random arbitrary number. Now, I think it's the WHO, the World Homicide Organization, is now telling kids they're okay 3 feet apart. Why is it different for children than adults? But there was a study out of MIT that said, well, you know, there's aerosol spread. And some physicists studied flow projections from the aerosols. It didn't matter if it was 6 feet or 60 feet. The aerosols spread that far, and they linger in the air. So 6 feet apart, what malarkey. Hand washing possibly has some value, but the problem is you see people obsessively using these chemical sanitizers all day long. Those chemicals are absorbed through our skin and create their own problems. If you're going to engage in hand washing, just do it where you have pure soap and water. That's the easiest. And there is value in hand washing, but not when you're doing it with these chemical sanitizers. The lockdowns have shown to have no impact on the spread of this virus. To lock down an entire population makes no sense. And the epidemiologists who are willing to tell the truth have been really vocal about this. The pattern since the plague in the 1300s has been you find the sick and you isolate them. Those are the ones who should be quarantined, and the rest of society goes about their business. But not with this pandemic. The entire population has been locked down. But the lockdowns have caused worse economic and social damage, with more lives lost and permanently ruined than were ever saved by this crazy process. Especially when you consider all the bankruptcies, the foreclosures, the evictions, the domestic violence, substance abuse, suicides, overdose deaths have skyrocketed. No one's done a cost-benefit analysis of this strategy. It doesn't work, and it has tremendous, permanent, long-lasting harm. How do we know they don't work? Well, you can look at the outliers, which are the countries that didn't do this and the states that didn't do this. I know Sweden, Belarus, of all places, and Haiti, and several other nations never locked down. And nationally, South Dakota, Texas, and Florida, I'm not sure if there are others, but South Dakota, from the get-go, somehow resisted all the pressure and never locked down and never had a mask mandate. So you can go to worldometers.com, which is on your reference handout. They're a very good website. There are a number of others that do this, but I just like their graphs and charts. And they compare the curve of South Dakota with other states that had really draconian lockdowns, and you'll see that their curves over time are similar of the spread of the virus and their death curves. There's really not any difference between states that locked down fully and states that didn't lock down at all. So the best-kept secret seems to be the fact that there are effective, curative, early treatments for COVID infections. It personally grieves me that every hospitalization and just about every death, I think, is blood in the hands of my colleagues who don't know about these treatments or know about them and ignore them and will not give them to their clients. So the main treatments that have been studied, first off, is hydroxychloroquine, which is an antimalarial product that's been used for 70 years. It really needs to be given with zinc, because the value of hydroxychloroquine is to open little pores in cell walls and let zinc in. And zinc is a tremendous antiviral. It's often given with an antibiotic, which is really to prevent a bacterial superinfection. The main ones are azithromycin, or there's a doctor in Romania who likes clarithromycin better, or another one, an old-time antibiotic named doxycycline. And those are the three that are used with hydroxychloroquine. So there are a number of studies of hydroxychloroquine. I'm just getting things out of order here. Sorry, I have a detailed list that's guiding me here. The studies that have shown to disprove hydroxychloroquine were—you don't even have to read them closely, but it is worthwhile reading them. They were designed to fail. There was a VA study who used older black men who probably with poor nutrition who were already on a ventilator. They are the proverbial situation of one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel, and they give them hydroxychloroquine. All these treatments that I will talk to you about are meant to be given very early, the first sign, even without a positive PCR test. Just do it. They're so effective and so safe. Well, there was a Brazil study that used a lethal dose, 8 times the normal dose of hydroxychloroquine. No wonder they showed that the death rate was higher in the treated group. And then the best one of all is the study that was sent by a company with the surprising name of Surgisphere. The Surgisphere study, it's called. It was published in The Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine. I don't know how this got past their usual censors, but Surgisphere study was a total fraud. Somebody fabricated a database and fabricated all the numbers and got this study published in The Lancet and the New England Journal. Based on this study, a number of countries banned the use of hydroxychloroquine, and clinical trials that were in progress were stopped. Then it was discovered the study was a total fraud. The Lancet was in the embarrassing position of having to retract this study. It might be the only time in the 100-plus year history of the Lancet that they've ever retracted a study, and so did the New England Journal of Medicine. One other thing we can point to is the fact that countries, especially Africa, now you think Africa, with their absolutely miserable healthcare system, would have soaring death rates because they're countries with predominantly black people who, with their darker skin, can't make as much vitamin D, so they're more prone to being vitamin D deficient, poor nutrition, no money to speak of. But it's not true. Just go to Worldometers and look up any country in Africa, and they have an astoundingly low death rate. Why? Because they all have a long history of passing out hydroxychloroquine to their population because it's a malaria preventive. It's known popularly as the Sunday drug. It's over-the-counter in just about all countries in Africa. You pick it up for a couple of cents a tablet, and they take one or two tablets every Sunday, and they have for decades. So the next one is ivermectin, which is another parasitic drug. I think ivermectin is nosing it out as a better treatment than hydroxychloroquine, especially used with zinc, of course. Ivermectin is also a good prophylactic as well in a lower dose. It's the only one I've seen that's a pharmaceutical product that can prevent COVID infections. If we wanted to really affect this pandemic, we would not be passing out vaccines. We would be passing out ivermectin to just about everybody. It's a very safe drug. It's been around for 50 years. The next one is less well known, but it's an inhaled steroid called budesonide. There's a Dr. Bartlett. I think of him. I remember him by thinking of what well, like the pear, Bartlett pears, in I think Odessa, Texas. Who he won't shut up for love or money. He pioneered the use of budesonide, and he's had virtually 100% success treating his patients. You can find out a lot more about these treatments and others at the protocols that are listed on two websites that are in your resource handout. The first one is American Frontline Doctors, and the second one is Frontline COVID Critical Care Alliance. They both have protocols posted, and they're pretty much the same. Dr. Merkula recommends nebulized hydrogen peroxide. Now, I know everyone's going to recoil in horror. This is a very, 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 very dilute, low-dose peroxide. And he has a video about exactly how to dilute it. You just start with 3% peroxide that you can get in any supermarket, and he shows you how to dilute it down. Nebulizers do not need a prescription. You can go into any big box pharmacy or a supermarket and buy one. Vitamin D, sunshine and 5,000 units a day, every day. Vitamin D has been shown to prevent 85% of the deaths when it's been studied, even in hospitalized patients. 85% just by taking vitamin D. Another treatment that is prophylactic, meaning it will prevent people from getting the virus, but it's less effective than hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, but it's a combination of two natural products. One is a bioflavonoid named quercetin, and of course, zinc, our all-purpose standby mineral for fighting virus infections. A new kid on the block is a drug named Suramin, and it is a derivative of pine needle extract tea, which is available. You can just look up pine needle extract tea on the internet, and a number of sellers will be happy to send it to you. Oil of oregano is a very powerful antiviral. Argentin silver, there are lots of different silvers on the market, but I like Argentin because it's more highly concentrated. Both vitamin C and vitamin A have tremendous antiviral properties. I personally think that the salt form of vitamin C, which is called ascorbate, is more effective than the acid form of vitamin C, which is called ascorbic acid. And vitamin A, I do suggest vitamin A itself, not some of the precursors like alpha carotene or beta carotene, but vitamin A itself, 25,000 units a day. A new one I just read about is dandelion leaf tea. Has antiviral properties and is specifically active against SARS-2. Another one that's very important that's not discussed much at all is glutathione. And our bodies make glutathione, but our ability to manufacture it decreases in a linear fashion as we age. There's a theory that one of the reasons, if not the main reason, that little children are so much more resilient against this infection is because their little bodies have so much more glutathione floating around. So another one, I'm sorry this was not in the handout, I just read about it a couple of nights ago, is turmeric and/ curcumin. They're two different names of the same product, pretty much. Turmeric is the spice that's used a lot in India, and curcumin is a product that's one of the ingredients in that spice. Also, essential fatty acids, which means omega-3 type fatty acids, especially the kind called DHA. We're usually stuck with a combination of DHA and the other essential fatty acid called EPA, in products in the health food stores. I have to think that it's possible to get DHA by itself. So, but what happened? All these treatments are out there. And I'll tell you from listening to interviews with the people who first developed these treatments, they expected to be on every talk show. They expected to be interviewed on every single newscast. They expected to be lined up for a Nobel Prize. They figured out how to effectively treat this infection. But what happened? They faced total denigration, absolute ridicule. Their Facebook, Instagram, whatever pages were deplatformed. The information was totally suppressed. When I saw that happening, that's when I realized that there has to be another agenda at work that has absolutely nothing to do with public health, because these people would be lauded as the heroes that they are if the real goal were to end this infection. So why did the politics go the way they did? Well, first of all, I think that knowing that there are effective treatments out there that are especially so cheap and easy to use, it would steer people away from taking the vaccines. And this has been about the vaccines from day one. So anything that's not a vaccine that works had to be eliminated from the discussion. The second reason is that products that are in the vaccines, especially that are approved for emergency authorization usage, they're authorized. It's the FDA has granted them emergency authorization usage status. They're not approved by the FDA. They have not been forced through the rigorous multi-year, multi-stage testing that any approval process requires. They were just pushed on the market with literally a two-month follow-up period of observation. So but vaccines are approved for emergency use. They cannot be approved if there's any other effective treatment available. That's part of the prerequisites for emergency use. There can't be any other effective treatment. Well, these are effective treatments. They're very safe and effective. So, of course, they had to be eliminated from the discussion so we could rush headlong into these vaccines. Natural immunity is another topic whose information has been soundly suppressed. Some scientists looked at some people who had contracted SARS-1 years and years ago, were still alive. They volunteered, they drew blood, and I can't say cultured because the virus has never been cultured, but they mixed the blood with probably with samples of blood that had evidence of SARS-2, and lo and behold, they still produced antibodies against SARS-2 after 17 years. So, and this is not the only study, of course. We've known that natural immunity from an infection provides long-term, very complete protection that may last for one's lifetime. So natural immunity has been shown to also be effective against the new variants, which I'll talk about. The natural immunity involves both T cells and B cells and memory T cells and memory B cells, whereas the vaccines just produce very, very highly specific antibodies only. And we have no idea how long they last, but we're beginning to see signs that they don't even last beyond 6 months. So what about people who had an infection, presumed infection anyway, and now have natural immunity? I think, and so do a number of other physicians, believe that they are at very high risk of severe problems from taking the vaccine after they've had a natural infection. The closer in time from the natural infection to the vaccine, the more the higher at risk they are of developing severe complications, including death. There was a study out of Cleveland that conclusively showed that if you have natural immunity, vaccination confers no additional benefit. And people who have had immunity do not need to be vaccinated and really should not be vaccinated because of their higher risk. What are we looking at in the future? There are variants that are coming. A few doctors are calling them samients instead of variants because their genetic drift has been so slight. I mean, when you think that SARS-1 compared to SARS-2 only has an 80% overlap in their amino acid sequences, and yet people who had SARS-1 17 years ago are mounting a robust antibody response against SARS-2. So the coming variants really have far less than 20% amino acid difference. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, already. It's just that attention has been forcibly focused on the big five, I guess. And they used to be named by the country of origin. So the Alpha variant really was originally called the English variant. The Delta variant was called the Indian variant because it first arose in India and so forth. But that was considered politically incorrect. So now they're just given Greek alphabet numbers. there's misinformation floating around that the Delta variant is 1,000 times more infectious. That's really not true at all. Where that comes from is the determination that there were 1,000 times more virus particles in some people's nasal passages that tested positive for the COVID infection. So people therefore misinterpreted that as being 1,000 times more infectious. No, they're not. They're perhaps 66% more infectious than the Alpha strain, which in turn is 50% more infectious than the Wuhan strain, which has largely disappeared at this point. It's the variants have taken over. So, but we really have to look at cases, new cases versus hospitalization rate and death rate. This virus is doing what viruses do. They mutate to more transmissible and less lethal strains. That's how they can propagate and survive. If a virus killed off its host in one day, it's not going to go anywhere. It's going to die out very, very quickly. So it's a survival advantage to viruses to become more easily transmitted, but let their host stay alive longer or forever to keep transmitting the virus. So we're now starting to hear a constant barrage of talk about a pandemic of the unvaccinated. But they're not talking about hospitalizations and deaths because all of those are absolutely plummeting. England and Israel is a bit more honest about their statistics. England has published studies that very, very recently that 40% of the people going into the hospital are doubly vaccinated. And the Israeli study showed that 60% of the people in the hospital and 30% of all deaths are people who have been fully vaccinated. So it's not true that we're having a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Remember my discussion earlier about how the testing is being deliberately skewed to give the appearance that only the unvaccinated are acquiring this infection. It's just not true. So the last topic really is the vaccines, which is the other outrageous fraud in this entire scenario. The legal status of the vaccines, as I explained, they have FDA emergency use authorization. They do not have FDA approval, and they are still considered to be an experimental, unproven drug. Pfizer, there are four drugs out there, three of which have been approved in America. Pfizer and Moderna, as everyone knows, I'm sure, they use messenger RNA in a lipid capsule, and that's to preserve the messenger RNA and to somehow manage to get it inside cells where the capsule magically dissolves and the messenger RNA is now floating around in the cytoplasm, and it induces cells that it has invaded to make a certain protein, which is called the spike protein. It's the spike protein in the virus that allows it to attach to cells and break open the cell wall and invade the cells. And now we've got our entire body cranking out this spike protein. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the AstraZeneca vaccine do not do that. They use attenuated adenoviruses. Why they chose that, I'm not sure. But the end result is all the same. All four drugs induce our cells to produce spike proteins. So the limitations on the vaccines that has been so misrepresented, we need to look at what they were designed to do, what they've been tested to do, and what they have since been tracked to do. They were designed and tested and tracked to decrease the seriousness of infections, which is to say, how many symptoms did you have? How serious was it? Now, it could be as simple as a doctor asking a vaccine trial participant, have you had a cough in the last month? Yes. How many times did you cough? Oh, maybe 10 times. Okay. Next participant, how many times did you cough last month? Oh, 3 times. Oh, okay. Well, your symptoms are lessened. that must mean that the vaccine is working. That is literally the level of the science that is backing these vaccines. Do these vaccines create immunity against future infections in someone who has taken them? There is a resounding no. No, they do not create immunity against future infections. Have they been shown to decrease transmission of the virus by someone who has taken a vaccine? No, they have not been shown to decrease transmission. Do they protect against the new variants? Not so much, as the English and the Israeli studies have shown. But is this what's portrayed in the media every night? No. So here are some examples of, and now you can see through this. You can discern what is propaganda and what is truth. You're urged to get the vaccine to protect yourself and your community. Well, that can only happen if, A, the person getting the vaccine develops immunity to the infection. They can only protect the community if they decrease transmission, neither of which has been shown to be accomplished by any of these vaccines. Here's the emotional ploy. Do it to save Granny. Well, what does that mean? That means that you have to be immune from infection and decrease transmission. So Granny's been saved. Another one has been, vaccines are the only way to reach herd immunity. That can never happen with these vaccines because they do not create immunity in the person who's taken them. They do not decrease transmission. By definition, you cannot reach herd immunity that way. But they do decrease the seriousness of infections, probably. So we could intuit that down the road, that will mean that there will be fewer hospitalizations and fewer deaths. But that hasn't been shown yet. And with Israel reporting that 60% of the people going into the hospital are fully immunized, are vaccinated, that's not immunization. It would seem that these vaccines do not even decrease against the seriousness of symptoms. Do it to protect the children. Well, that's the same argument, same phony propaganda. You can't protect the children unless these vaccines create immunity and decrease or eliminate transmission of the virus. Children, by the way, are not drivers of this infection. They largely just bounce back. They are highly unlikely to transmit this infection, even to family members after close contact. Another myth that's floating around is that vaccination equals immunization. Get the vaccine so you don't get the infection. No less a personage than President Biden said that just recently. But that's not true at all. You can easily become reinfected after getting the vaccine. And, of course, the last one is, well, the unvaccinated are just selfish, ignorant dolts who are dangerous to the population. Well, no. Anyone who's had the infection is immune, we believe. And anyone who doesn't want to be party to the side effects and has a sense not to get vaccinated, there. In fact, a recent study looked at people who chose not to get vaccinated, even at this point in time, and found that these people they're not ignorant. They're highly informed. They're science literate. They're basically intelligent and educated. They're more likely to critically evaluate what they're being told and even go to the sources and read the studies. They're not just ignorant louts at all. So the trials themselves had a lot of problems. With the Moderna trial, you would think that if you're measuring a vaccine against a placebo, you're going to use a real placebo. Well, Pfizer did, actually. They bowed to a lot of public pressure and used a saline solution as the placebo. Moderna, not so much. The placebo is the vaccine that's used presently to treat meningitis, not water at all. They probably did that, it's just my opinion, because the side effects of the meningitis vaccine would mirror the side effects from the COVID vaccine, and it would appear that the treated group did not have more side effects than the placebo group. We don't know, really. Moderna has released no data of its trial results or methodology or anything. Pfizer, they actually, all of them, because they were only going for emergency use approval, they skipped the usual animal studies that in themselves can take a couple of years. And the animal studies that were performed on previous COVID vaccine trial proposals, they never got beyond the animal studies because the animals generally died when they were exposed to the real virus. Oh, the animals produced a great antibody response. The vaccine makers thought that they were home free. But then when the animals contracted the infection they were being vaccinated against, they had horrible immune system overdrive, organ failure, and they died. So they never progressed to human trials. Now the humans are the animals because they skipped the animal studies. Pfizer, we know, excluded anyone who's been previously infected, anyone who was over a certain age, anyone who had other medical problems, and pregnant women. Well, who do we really want to know stands to gain from this? Which would be people over a certain age, people with other medical problems, pregnant women, and people who were previously infected, but they were excluded from the trials. Here's the worst part, in my opinion. They had 40,000 people in the Pfizer trial. They stopped the trial after they had 170 symptomatic cases, which means just 170 positive PCR tests. In 40,000 people, that is 0.42%, less than one-half of 1%. I mean, who calls an election when one-half of 1% of the vote is counted? But they considered that sufficient. They never retested all the trial subjects. They never gave everybody a PCR test to see how many asymptomatic cases there might be out there. So we have no idea what the real incidence was in the 40,000 people that Pfizer tested. They also ended their trial after 3 months, and they said, Pfizer said, it would be unethical to continue the control group and not give them the benefit of the vaccine. So they gave the drug to the control group. That means there is no ongoing control group for comparison. They terminated their study. There's no follow-up. Everyone who's now taking the vaccine is kind of the de facto phase 3 long-term study. So because there's no longer-term monitoring going on, we have no idea of the long-term effects of this drug, these vaccines. So it is a fraud and a lie to say they have been proven safe and effective. We don't know much of anything about their safety or their effectiveness. For the use in children, you may know the now trials are ramping up to use them in children. First it was 12 to 15, now it's under 12. I think it's now 6 to 12. The idea is to pump these vaccines into children as young as 6 months. But the vaccine itself is more dangerous than the infection in children. The head lady at the CDC made a statement recently that a million vaccinated children will prevent 200 hospitalizations and one death. A million children vaccinated with this product. But their main side effect, or one of the main side effects, is myocarditis, which is a heart inflammation. The incidence of myocarditis in children has been estimated to be 1 in 50,000. So the million vaccinated kids are going to contract statistical probability, there'll be 20 cases of myocarditis, some of which will be fatal, in a vaccine for children that will prevent one death. Now, there's a new Johns Hopkins study just a few days ago. They showed zero deaths in healthy infected children. So why do we need a vaccine to prevent one death in a population that has zero deaths to begin with? There's talk about using boosters, and that's because the protection seems to be waning after just 6 months. So now there's discussion about doing these injections every 6 months for life. presumably altered slightly as the virus changes its genomic makeup a tiny bit each time. Well, what about, so this whole situation has been about rushing people into these vaccines. It's been about the vaccines all along, I think. So what is in these vaccines? Why is it so important to get them into every arm on the planet? We do know that polyethylene glycol, which is abbreviated PEG, is in these vaccines, and or another product called polysorbate 80. These are both highly antigenic products, and they may be responsible for some of the sudden deaths that we're seeing immediately, I mean like within minutes or hours or within a few days of taking the vaccine, even just one dose. I think there are other unknown ingredients in these vaccines. We don't know anything about the mercury content, which is in other vaccines, the aluminum content, which is in other vaccines. We don't know if there are fetal cells in any of these vaccines. We think there's been some recent work that to the effect that, that a product called graphene oxide, and that's G-R-A-P-H-E-N-E, graphene oxide, is in these vaccine injections, and it may make up 90% of the volume. Graphene oxide is a nasty, serious product. It promotes blood clotting, and it decreases immune system functions, among other things. It's also activated at frequencies that seem to be in the range of 5G. And this may be the basis for the conjecture, and it's really all it is, that there is an association between these vaccines and the 5G phone lines that are being installed everywhere. There's also something with magnetic properties in these vaccines, and now that may be the graphene because it does have electromagnetic properties. You may have seen some of the videos posted about people sticking magnets to their vaccinated arm, and the magnets stick, whereas they fall off from the unvaccinated arm. As time goes on, though, people who've been vaccinated have magnets that stick on other parts of their body. There's also something in these vaccines that will fluoresce when a black light is shined on it. We don't know if it's the graphene itself. It may be this product called luciferase. That's L-U-C-I-F-E-R-A-S-E, to which Bill Gates has a patent. It is known to be a bioluminescent enzyme, and it may be a way of being able to shine a black light on someone and determining if they've actually been vaccinated or not. In addition, those who've been vaccinated are shedding something. We don't know, but that whatever that something is, it seems to be affecting those who are non-vaccinated, especially women. Women have reported all sorts of bleeding problems, menstrual problems. Women who are 70 years old and are suddenly having periods again. We don't know what it is, but it is real, and it is having noticeable effects on people. Other unknown ingredients, the main one is HCG, which is human chorionic gonadotropin. This was found to be in tetanus doses that were given to African women. It does promote abortions. And a group of Catholic bishops, I think in South Africa, but in Malawi, I honestly forget, took these vaccines and analyzed them, and they found HCG in almost every single dose and went to the manufacturer. I think Bill Gates was behind that one, and they just said, oh, gee, how did that happen? We're so sorry. So these vaccines are really hardly safe and effective. They have side effects that are mild to severe, including death. We only have a passive reporting system called VAERS, V-A-E-R-S, which is appropriately enough Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. It's a voluntary system. Anyone can do it, but a lot of people don't know that, and they don't know how to do it. It's been estimated that VAERS picks up only between 1 5% and 10% of all adverse events. But to date, and I think this is largely the result of some efforts to get the public to report these events, not just physicians, there have been 12,000 deaths reported in America, 500,000 side effects, and a lot of MDs will not fill out a report, or else they don't know what the VAERS system is, or patients have reported that some MDs have told them, well, the vaccines are safe and effective, so all your problems that develop 2 days after taking the vaccine can't have any relationship to the vaccine, because we all know the vaccines are safe and effective. So as if that's not enough, the CDC makes it difficult to finish a report and actually submit it. And after it's submitted, the CDC, for no apparent reason, can choose to scrub it and not include it in the database. Hardly anyone is doing autopsies on these people, so we really don't have a comparison of what is killing them. And the CDC, of course, denies any relationship to the vaccine. It's just a coincidence that people died within 1 hour to 28 days after taking the vaccine. So, you know, death by coincidence is emerging as a major killer in this country. The European reporting system is more accurate, which is to say it picks up maybe 30% of events, but with half the population of the United States, they've already recorded 17,000 deaths and 1.5 million side effects, most of which are serious. So there's now this saying going around that, well, if you get side effects, it's proof the vaccine is working. No, it's not. It's proof that the vaccine is dangerous to the recipient. That's all it proves, not effectiveness. So what are the side effects? I've divided them into short-term, intermediate-term, and long-term side effects. The short-term side effects are anaphylactic shock, which has happened, seizures, and death within hours or 14 days. These vaccines promote clotting problems, which can result in strokes, heart attacks, platelet decrease, which then promotes bleeding, microclots that are not picked up on standard imaging tests, but there is one blood test called a D-dimer that will give evidence of very recent microclots. And one physician in England found he called all his patients back, and he tested every single one of them for D-dimers, and he found that two-thirds of them had evidence of microclots throughout their body. These vaccines also promote inflammation in many organs and blood vessels. Well, why does this happen? It can't happen if the vaccines are confined to the deltoid muscle in the arm where they're injected. And indeed, they don't stay there. About 75% of the vaccine contents circulates throughout the body and crosses the blood-brain barrier. In addition, and what's really important to realize is there is no off switch to these vaccines. Maybe the messenger RNA that they inject naturally degrades over time, but there's no way to turn this process off once it's switched on in someone's body. Then there's the myocarditis, which is a short-term effect we're seeing mostly in children, lung compromise and chronic shortness of breath, brain problems with manifesting as seizures, tremors, and debilitating fatigue. Now, why do these symptoms show up? This is my personal theory. I haven't done anything to prove it yet, but just intuitively it makes sense. There are some slides posted on the internet of what red cells look like under a microscope before getting a vaccine and after getting a vaccine. And the red cells beforehand are nice and beautiful and round, and they're separated. There's lots of them. And after getting a vaccine, they're shrunken. They stick together. They just don't function very well at all. Well, red cells carry oxygen. And I think there's a tremendous oxygen deprivation from these effects of the vaccines on red blood cells. The second situation is I think these vaccines act as a metabolic poison that affect the mitochondria. Mitochondria are little energy producers that are found scattered throughout our cells, everywhere in the body, especially the heart. The heart is like 40% mitochondria. And I think that this is a mitochondrial dysfunction coupled with oxygen deprivation from destroying the red cells. So some other symptoms that show up are now known are a Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a sort of paralysis that usually is treatable. One has to be put on a ventilator until such time as it goes away, but it usually does go away. And the other one that's concerning is loss of pregnancy. Women, now again, the study conflated the results. They simply combined those women who had a spontaneous abortion and those women who had a miscarriage and said, well, those events are exceedingly low. But when you really tease apart the data, there's a difference between a spontaneous abortion, which occurs in the first 6 months of pregnancy, called the first trimester and the second trimester, and a miscarriage, which occurs between 6 and 9 months of pregnancy. So when they separated out the information, the reviewers discovered that 80%, which is 4 out of 5 women who got this vaccine in their first 6 months of pregnancy, did have a spontaneous abortion, and the rest, the 20%, had a miscarriage. So we move on to the intermediate term side effects, which are really just projected. We have no idea. These vaccines have only been studied for follow-up of 3 months. The intermediate side effects will last 3 to 5 years, and they may start showing up in 12 months or so. It's quite possible we will see excessive deaths from the variants, from the new forms of the SARS-2 infection in those people who have been vaccinated. And again, the Israeli and England studies seem to show that. We're likely to see continued heart, kidney, lung, and brain damage showing up, which will show up as heart failure, early kidney failure, which means going on dialysis, hypertension or high blood pressure that's confined to the lungs, chronic shortness of breath, chronic fatigue, epilepsy, cognitive decline, and then the big three, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and ALS, which is Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. I think we're going to see autoimmune diseases of all sorts because the spike protein either gloms onto cells throughout the body that the white cells misread as a foreign invader, so they start attacking the body's own cells. That's the definition of an autoimmune disease. And we're going to see continuing clotting problems, which will show up as strokes and heart attacks. The long-term side effects will last between 5 and 25 years, and it may take that long to have them show up. And those will mainly be continuing cancers, and autoimmune diseases, and the same, the trifecta of Alzheimer's, ALS, and Parkinson's, neurological damage, and also what looks like multiple sclerosis, but is probably going to be just a look-alike from the white cells attacking the brain neurons. One of the biggest worries and concerns for me is long-term infertility. And we have no idea about that. But there's a protein called syncytin, which is responsible for maintaining the placenta during pregnancy. Syncytin looks for all the world like the spike protein. And this may be why the pregnant women who are getting this vaccine have a marked tendency to abort their pregnancy. It's another autoimmune phenomenon. The white cells misread the syncytin protein for the spike protein and go after it. So if you are suffering from these side effects, even the short-term ones, what are you going to do? Who are you going to sue if disabled or dead? Well, the vaccine makers, as you may know, have been given total freedom from liability. They have no legal liability. You legally cannot sue a vaccine maker for damages from the vaccines. Even the people who are administering the vaccines, anyone involved with this process has, and that's the only immunity that I've found in all of this, and the vaccine makers and the givers have been immunized from legal liability. Some insurance companies will not pay medical bills if someone has side effects from these vaccines, because they rightly conclude that these drugs are experimental. They haven't been given FDA approval, just clearance for experimental emergency use. So you're on the hook if you have medical bills from these vaccines. Now, not every insurance company, so it's wise to proactively ask your insurance company what their policy is for vaccine damages. You can go to vaccine court. There's a new court that's been set up specifically for COVID vaccine damages. But it has significant problems. For one thing, the payouts, I believe, are capped at $300,000, and they seldom pay out. People think, oh, I'll just go to vaccine court, hold my hand out, tell them what happened, and I'll get money. It doesn't work that way. It's like a regular trial. You're the plaintiff. You have to prove that with your own experts that you have to pay for somehow that the vaccine caused your damage. And the Justice Department sends over its attorneys and their experts to convince a judge that, no, there's no way these vaccines could produce damage like this because they're safe and effective. Everybody knows that, Judge. So it's a long, drawn-out process. You don't get much money, relatively speaking, and they seldom pay out. So a lot of people don't even bother. So the take-home message for me personally is I fervently implore everyone not to get this shot. Do not get these injections. Change jobs, change states, homeschool your kids. I know that can be a really tall order and an overwhelming process to go through. But if we can remain somehow vaccine free for 3 years, I think that those who are not vaccinated are going to be left standing and functioning. And many, many, many of the people who have been vaccinated are not going to be standing and functioning. So, however, many people have taken the vaccine already. There are some things that you can do to protect yourself in the future, and here are my recommendations. Take ivermectin in the prophylactic preventive dose that is discussed on the America's Frontline Doctors and the COVID consortium. It's a low dose, and you take it forever. It does prevent infections, and it is effective against the variants. Vitamin D, 5,000 units a day. And the other nutrients are vitamin C in the ascorbate form, vitamin A, selenium, zinc, and lysine are ones that we haven't really talked about, but they're very significant antivirals. And glutathione that I mentioned a bit earlier, glutathione degrades the graphene that is in these vaccines, or apparently is in these vaccines. It stimulates white blood cells. And the best kind to take is called reduced glutathione that you can just swallow. There is an IV form. There is a nebulized form. But you have to get a prescription pharmaceutical-grade glutathione to do nebulized or IV. Another product is lumbrokinase, or alternately natokinase. Lumbrokinase is just amazing. There's one company really in Canada who makes it. It's somewhat expensive, but it dissolves clots and microclots. So it can actually protect people, I think, long-term from the tendency to form these microclots that are causing so many other problems. Another one are anti-inflammatories, which is curcumin or turmeric, and essential fatty acids, especially DHA, which I believe I mentioned previously. What are we looking at for the future? Well, it's clear to me, I hope I'm wrong, but this is my prediction. We're going to see another complete lockdown this fall, because of all the hype about the variants, probably by October. So if you're thinking about stocking up on supplies, now is a good time to do that. We're also looking at mandates of these vaccines, even without FDA approval. We're seeing this at the corporate level, universities, and government. I think either tomorrow or maybe Friday, I believe President Biden is going to announce that all federal employees must show that they've been vaccinated. Sometimes the command is show that you've been vaccinated or have recently recovered from an infection, and that's proven by antibodies in the blood, although you don't always make antibodies, or recent PCR tests that are negative. But I've told you the problems with the PCR tests, too. I think we have to fight back against these mandates. Now, there are letters that are featured in the websites for Children's Health Defense, America's Frontline Doctors, and a new one I found out about. I'm sorry it's not in your handout. Sydney Powell, whom you know from her work with the problems with the election back in November, her website is defendingtherepublic.org, and she has a very good letter posted. I think these letters can serve to alert corporations and universities, maybe not so much the government, that if they mandate this vaccine and someone has side effects or death, especially the children, from it, that you intend to hold them liable. They are not protected from liability. And when you start talking money, that's when they start listening. The next one coming is the vaccine passports. You know, it's crazy how today's conspiracy theory is next year's headlines. And that's exactly what is happening here. People who talked about vaccine passports last year and in months past were just dismissed as tinfoil hat kooks. And now we're seeing it in all the headlines. The vaccine passports are not confined to vaccines or this vaccine. They can expand to become a personal ID card and have all sorts of medical, personal, and financial information on them. They're starting to be called a digital wallet, not a digital vaccine record, which I think is a forecaster of things to come. Once these things are in place, they are never going away. The coming variants and the perceived need for booster shots will guarantee that this vaccine passport situation will only get more intense. And it's just not just limited to this vaccine. The corollary is, though, that we're going to be experiencing constant and universal surveillance, tracking, and testing. Testing, testing, testing. For a virus that has a 99.45 or so percent survival rate without doing anything. You may know about the World Economic Forum. It's worthwhile going to their website periodically because they tell you what they intend. The Economic Forum is composed of the world's richest and most powerful people, and they have the means and the opportunity and certainly the intention to implement certain goals that they want on the rest of us worldwide. And one of the goals that they have been promoting is a cashless society. And now we're looking at money as literally filthy lucre, contaminated with the virus, although the money's been studied and it's never been shown to communicate the virus from one person to another. But I encourage you to read the book that the founding father of the World Economic Forum, named Klaus Schwab, wrote recently. It's called COVID and the Great Reset. And he pretty much sums up and announces everything they would like to do. There's a very good article on this on the Children's Health Defense website. It's named Pandemic Beneficiaries Are Converging. And it's a long analysis, but it's worth the time to read it. So I do think that above the daily give and take about this, that there is an aspect of good versus evil and godly versus satanic aspect to this coming situation. It's we've never had anything like this before, where society is shut down en masse in unison all across the world. And conventional media all around the planet is saying the same thing, almost as if they're mouthing the same script. So, but what can we do? What actions to take? I think that silence does give consent, or at least assent. And this is an area you folks are much more familiar with. So I think it's important to really raise your voice now, especially locally. Who was it? Everett Dirksen said all politics is local, and that's where it starts. So I would suggest go down to the local council or assembly or whatever you call it and testify. Show up and get things into the record. Get on the talk shows. That's a really easy way to spread some thoughts. And they generally, depending on the persuasion of the talk show host, but there are a lot of conservative talk shows out there, they welcome people who would spread awareness about this vaccine situation and the coming mandates and the coming vaccine passports. Another thing to do is support the people financially who are on the resource list, because they've already been talking their heads off and they will not shut up for love or money, and they deserve our support. Lastly, I think this is going to be decided in courts, personally. So, and you folks are far better equipped for this, is to start looking at legal strategies. And I don't think we're going to get anywhere until we can figure out how to strip officials, state and local, really, of their immunity. So a personal liability attaches to their horrible decisions that have such a tremendous economic and social and psychological detrimental effect. Now, federal laws, this has to be researched, might give full protection against politicians, but I don't know. The people who manufacture and deliver these vaccines, absolutely, you cannot sue them. But public officials who are making decisions based on no science and no facts, maybe. So I would think the process would be sequential. First, make sure that they are aware of the scientific studies that debunk masks and social distancing and lockdowns. And I would process serve them on them. So we get an objective third party who would say, yes, I handed these documents and here's the list to these people. And that really removes any thought of plausible denial. With, of course, an appropriate cover letter saying that they'll be acting in a knowing, willful, arbitrary, and capricious manner with liability for the consequences. And, of course, we all know about oaths of office, that they're acting outside the scope of their delegated authority and perjuring their oath of office. So that I'd say a word about the handouts that Daniel so kindly distributed to everyone. One of the most important is the one I typed up for you about the difference between relative risk reduction and absolute risk reduction. And when you read it, you will understand why drug companies just love to talk about relative risk reduction, because it just makes their products look so much better than they really are. But when you start thinking in terms of absolute risk reduction, if this virus has a 0.5% death rate, that means that 99.5% of the people who do absolutely nothing will survive it. It's really hard to improve on that. So if the vaccine increases that from 99.5 to 99.8, that's a 0.3% advancement or protection in risk reduction. Is it really worth it to do something that is not approved with side effects that are increasing every day, destroying people's lives, for that level of absolute true risk reduction? So I would encourage you to read the difference between relative risk and absolute risk. I never understood why other people were saying this vaccine actually confers a realistic risk reduction of less than 1%. And I said, why are they saying that? What are they getting these numbers from? Well, when I did this analysis myself, it became crystal clear. Oh, they're using the absolute risk reduction. Very easy to determine. So your resource list, I thought it would be more meaningful and helpful if it wasn't just listening to Joan Priestley, but if you had access to the people that I look to for guidance and sanity, basically. And the two best that I have found is Del Bigtree at The High Wire and the Children's Health Defense. Del is an interviewer, and he's interviewed just about everybody else on that whole list and a lot more. Children's Health Defense is geared towards lawsuits, and they're very good at this. So, you know, why should we invent the wheel? Just go and read their lawsuits and see how the pros have already framed the issues. So lastly, I would just like to let folks know one other thing. I didn't start out majoring in biology and chemistry and then going on to medical school. I was sort of a maverick outlier. I have a undergraduate degree in English literature and English, really, and journalism. And I worked for several years as an investigative journalist before I went into medicine and went to medical school. So along the way, I've taken a lot of paralegal courses, and I've also had, I got marched through all of 18th century rules of English grammar, and I'm just blessed to be really good as an editor. I've worked professionally as an editor forever. And I would be honored and privileged to contribute my editorial acumen and services at no charge to anyone in this group. I can guarantee I can improve your paperwork. So several companies that I've worked with in the past have sent their position papers around to their editorial staff, and then they send them on to me, and I pick up everything that they've missed. So that's my gift from God. Is I'm really blessed to be very good as an editor, and I would be happy to contribute that service to in furtherance of the efforts that the people are doing here in this group. So with that, I will say thank you, and we are open for questions.
Wow. Well, I can tell you what, Joan. I've muted just about everybody out during the call to protect the recording. Thank you so much for that expose. I'm going to start unmuting people. Mute yourself out if there's a noise in the background. So I can get everybody unmuted that might want to ask questions. Of course, I've got only one question, Joan. You mentioned that it piqued my interest that the only state that you suggest to get tested in was Florida. Did I understand you correctly?
Oh, no. That's the only state that has mandated by the governor and their public health department that the laboratories have to list the number of cycles that they use. On any given sample.
So that
is useful information for a physician, because if somebody tests positive at 25 cycles, that's really likely to be an accurate true positive. Whereas if they test positive at 45 cycles, well, you can just say, well, just, you know, go home and take some vitamin C, because it's highly likely to be a false positive.
Well, that's it. Settles it for me, guys. I'm going to Florida, and I just needed an excuse to get there. And, no, Joan, you did a wonderful job. I'm going to suggest to the listening audience here tonight, you've been unmuted. Has anybody got a question for our guest tonight, special guest?
Well, this is John, and I can say one thing. Most of the people in here have read a lot of my documents. And when I first met Joan decades ago, she was editing my documents, and it looked like a hen with a red ink pen on every finger attacked my paperwork. But now then, it seems like after a few thousand gallons of red ink, I can maybe get it down sort of right now. She's very good.
Thank you, John.
Well, we've got some. We will definitely throw some projects your way and see if you have an interest in them.
Oh, absolutely. I did want to tell let people know one other thing. Some of these products, especially if you're using a lot of them, can be expensive, and the brands are of varying quality. But I, as a physician, I have accounts with a lot of these companies, and I'd be happy to make these products available if someone wants to order them, just for at my cost shipping plus a 10% markup, which is especially if someone wants to take the one called Lumbrokinase that is really excellent for dissolving clots. It's pricey. And I think people who've been vaccinated would want to take it for a long time. So I'm happy to use my those golden initials after my name to help people have access to these products.
Do you have
one other thing though?
I am
retired. I didn't give drug doses because I'm not in that business anymore. But there are excellent protocols listed on America's Frontline Doctors website. And the COVID Critical Care Alliance website, and they can put you in touch with physicians who will write prescriptions for those drugs for you.
Oh, that was my next question. Like the ivermectin that you mentioned earlier.
Right, right.
Sweet.
There are physicians across America who are happy to do this for people.
So I got a question based upon this future dystopia that you formulated that could potentially arise out of all of this totalitarian rulership. So do you see any problem with people just going in there and being, you know, cell phone in hand and being identified with, you know, registering their DNA and getting blood tested and getting identified as having this or having that and being profiled? Do you see any danger in that in your field, or is that just some conspiracy wacko theory stuff in your mind?
No, I mean, the vaccine passports will do just that. And if you don't have a vaccine in your body, your vaccine passport will alert anyone to that. You've heard, I assume or hope, about the door-to-door contact tracing. Now it's a door-to-door, let's try and convince you to get this vaccine. Well, how do they know whose door to go to? There have to be a list already that people are on if they've had this vaccine or not.
So there's a profile already created in your mind, whether it be artificial intelligence or some other form of registry, that's already starting to collect data currently. So I guess that concerns, obviously, people when they now they're afraid to go to their local doctors and get an ivermectin or whatever, any of the other recommended treatments, because now they're marking themselves to be in a registry. What do you think about that?
When a person gets a vaccine, that's required to be reported to the public health department with their personal information, which then goes on to the CDC. But just going to a doctor's office and getting ivermectin, that's not a reportable event.
Oh, that's good news. That'll help certain people, at least not now, at least not that we know. Maybe Mark Zuckerberg has got a program in the Google phones, and we're just not aware of it.
Yeah, you literally do never know. I mean, we're in so many databases now, it just boggles the mind.
It does, I know. All right, everybody, don't speak at once. Is there anybody got any questions? Joan, by the way, you did a thorough job. I'd be shocked someone have a question. I mean, it would be like they're thinking, you know, the TikTok, you know, they're trying to figure something out.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, usually people's questions come to mind, you know, 5 minutes after we've hung up. So if anyone has any thoughts down the road that they would like to answer,
I have a question.
Just contact Daniel.
I have a question.
Oh, okay.
I have a question.
Okay.
Hi. Thank you very much for your information and your time. And my name is Desiree. And my question is, should we have any concerns about the health condition of pilots when we get on planes?
Oh, pilots. That is a tough one. I'm aware of the situation with pilots not doing well, if they've been vaccinated. I'm not sure if vaccinated pilots are not allowed to fly, or if they, you know, you always have two pilots in the cockpit. If a vaccinated pilot is paired with an unvaccinated pilot, I don't know that situation, but I know that there's sort of rumblings on the internet about that. And if it is a concern, there's the only solution is to drive.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really bad. I have a question also.
Go ahead,
okay.
Please.
Okay, I'm on call. Harold Ellis, thank you for your time and the information that you have conveyed. I do have one question about what you call the vaccine, because based on my research, it's actually not a vaccine scientifically or by federal statute. So is there a reason why you call it a vaccine?
It's convenient. I understand the reasoning, and I do share it. A vaccine is supposed to be a product that confers immunity and decreases or eliminates transmission for people.
Correct.
And has long-term effects. These experimental gene-altering therapies do not do any of that. And in that sense, they are vaccines. It's very convenient for the drug industry and the media to call them vaccines, because then they come under the protection of that's afforded to vaccine manufacturers.
I think that, you know, if the right lawyers with the right fortitude would go on that point alone, that would topple everything, because it's all based on that. But I don't see too many lawyers of the system going after it.
No, that's true. There's Thomas, what is his last name? Retz, R-E-T-Z, I believe, who is filing lawsuits, and Dell Bigtree's organization, which is I Can Decide, is filing mm-hmm. lawsuits. Their major, Dell Bigtree's group mainly is filing Freedom of Information Act lawsuits. They're the ones that freed up 3,000 emails from Tony Fauci that are beginning to show a very damning picture about what he and others really thought about what they were doing, as opposed
correct.
To what they were you know, the platitudes they would mouth into the microphones. And Children's Health Defense is really going after people legally. That's what they're all about.
Yeah, but if they can cut them off at the foundation, it makes everything, because that's the fruit of the poisonous tree, the mislabeling of the product.
Right.
And in law terms, names, you know, words in general are precise and all have meaning. So just using the term vaccine when it's not scientifically or by federal statute miscasts the narrative and have led a lot of people to sleep.
Mm-hmm. I agree entirely.
Okay, that's all I have to
say. I have a question on the PCR test.
Okay.
Yes. Are they safe? Is that product, the ethylene oxide that some of those tests have, it's listed as a carcinogen. Is it safe, or what's your take on the PCR test?
Well, the you know, I don't want to sound too out there, but since you asked, certain products have been shown to be in the PCR swabs, and they're poking them way, way back in your
yeah.
in your pharynx, almost to the blood-brain barrier.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's thought that fragments of the vaccine, a lot of this is conjecture, that fragments of the virus itself and what's the other one? And the graphene oxide is in the PCR test. You could do a oral swab, and I would just before they were ready, I would spit something onto a piece of paper and say, here, swab this, so that the swab does not touch one's tongue, even. Remember, today's conspiracy theory is tomorrow's headlines. And I will say one more thing about the masks, as long as we're on that. I don't know if anyone's seen the videos on the internet about what seemed to be living, living thread-like organisms embedded in the masks. It's amazing. Right. So, and here we are all wearing, we're about to be forced to wear masks again.
Okay, well, I appreciate all your information. I appreciate your time, and I thank you for joining us.
Oh, I'm to the folks out there. I am absolutely thrilled. I just got a bug up my ass about this when I saw that Fauci and Birx and who was the third one? Redfield were doing it again. And with the same playbook and the same misrepresentations and outright lies. And I thought, you know, I've been here before, and I just started reading everything I could find about this. And I am so thrilled to have an audience to talk to, because I've spent months and months of my life reading these documents.
You were talking earlier about vitamin C, and you said ascorbic, and what's the other one?
Oh, vitamin C comes in two forms. It's a salt form and an acid form. The acid form is named ascorbic acid. And, you know, start reading the ingredients on bottles with vitamin C. Very few of them have the salt form, which is ascorbate. If you want to get vitamin C powder, it's more likely to come in the ascorbate form, which is better for you, I think.
Well, there's one that says acidic sodium, and there's one that says ascorbate crystal. Is the sodium the salt one?
Not if it says acidic.
Okay.
But if it says ascorbate crystals, yes, the powder form is much more likely to be the salt form, the ascorbate.
Yeah, it says vitamin C, non-acidic sodium, so I think that's the right one.
Oh, maybe that's right then. Okay.
Yeah, I just found it on Amazon. Thank you.
Okay. All right, good for you.
John,
all right.
This is John. One of the things, you know, when we start writing letters to these politicians and doing these protests about these four things, here's the deal. The thing in politics is you have to create liability. These guys run around and they're basically running around with no liability at all, because all they have to say is, oh, I didn't know that. Well, here's the thing. When you write them a letter, you give them I like to call it a notice of circumstances. And then you end that letter with a sentence that goes something like this. You know, this notice precludes you from pleading the defense of plausible deniability in the event that me or my family becomes disabled or dies or stumps our toe. And so what you're doing with that phrase is you're building a defendant's list. He can't say he didn't know. And if he had the ability to stop something from happening and he didn't do it, it's negligence. So anyway, that's just my little share and tell about how to create liability on a politician.
And I think we won't get anywhere until we do create that liability. That's the only thing they listen to.
Well,
that's ironic that John put it that way, because I develop a document that has a memorandum of understanding, conditional acceptance upon proof of claim, and they have an option on what they want to do. It was designed for employers. So, yes, and that was what in my mind was to create the liability. So within the memorandum of understanding is all the facts that I known at that time, which needs to be updated now. But, yes, and people who have used it, from what I gathered, it made the employer back up.
Well, now
the first thing that happens when they read that
and they see that term plausible deniability, they run it over to their lawyer, and their lawyer says, oh, you can't do this. You know, you're going to be liable for a suit if something happens to this guy or whatever. And they'll do one or two things. They either won't hire you or they'll fire you, one or the other. But they also may decide that they don't want to really enforce whatever policy they're thinking about if the word gets out to the other employees that the company would be liable for something in the decision that they're making.
Yeah, and I do cover that area about firing if they don't agree, because what happens is that in most jobs, you know, each one has to, you know, check the application in which they signed to get employment. But the issue of, how can I put that, the terms and conditions of the job at the time of signing are being changed or novated into another contract which you did not consent or agree to. So the parties agreed in the beginning on these terms, and now you're coming up with a new term out of the blue, forcing, you know, it's basically a forced mandate, and you object to the novation of the original contract. So that's what gets them to back off on the claim of firing you.
Yep. They're creating liability on themselves every day when they do that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Well, from what I hear, it's recommended that you don't quit your job. I understand, you go to HR and you tell them that you respectfully decline to get vaccinated, and that it is your wish to continue employment, but don't quit.
No. As soon as you say no, now you have put yourself in a position for them to react against adversely. When you say, I conditionally accept upon proof of claim, and you have...
I respectfully decline the vaccine.
Yeah. When you say you respectfully decline, you are putting yourself in jeopardy for them to react again because you refuse. This is what you don't want to give them. You don't want to give them refusal because that gives them cause. Huh?
I said you don't want to quit either.
Correct. So that's why the people that I've worked with,
You don't comply when they say, well, did you get your shot? Say, well, I hadn't got it yet. And then, you know, they say, well, did you get your shot? Say, no, I hadn't got it yet. Well, you just keep kicking it down the road till they finally make the decision that they're going to do something. Then you can react to that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You don't want to be the one to do it first. Make them go first. Because the way I do it, I say I'm not refusing, but I need more information. Provide me all of this information. It's like 14 questions, which they can't answer in their favor. It's all in your favor. You know before going in, like they tell you in law school, you never ask a question that you don't already know the answer to. So this is the premise in which we present this to them, and they can't win. Either way, first of all, they're not even doctors. See, this is what creates liability against them. Like Joan said, you know, the manufacturers, the ones who apply it, you know, you can't sue them based on the way they have it set up unless you go back to the foundation that it's not a vaccine in the first instance. That changes everything. I wish somebody would go down that road. But at any rate, by putting the onus on the employer, and I even say even those that are in government, to make them prove up the claim, and they can't. And if they try to fire you based on a novated contract that you didn't agree to, they are liable. Because that's what they're doing. They're asking you to novate the contract. If you consent or you do anything to the contract, you agree to the novation. You want to object to the novation. That's contract law.
All right. Got any other questions for Joan? That's very good, Harold. Thank you. of always pleasure to hear your voice.
You're welcome.
Well, feel free to contact Daniel if anything occurs to someone down the road.
I'm happy to be the intermediary. I'm hoping that everybody got the handouts that were in and attached to the email notification this week. If you were not and were invited to this call and did not get the handouts and would be interested, this is your chance to get a pen and a paper or your cell phone or somewhere to write it down, scratch it on your wall. Just don't use crayon. Here we go. I am Daniel Joseph at protonmail.com, and I would be more than happy to facilitate the resending of these documents and charts and the outline that we went through tonight was graciously provided for us. Okay, I am Daniel Joseph at protonmail.com. Our next House of Prayer call is going to be not in 2 weeks, but 3 weeks, like I announced earlier, on the 19th day of August of 2021, we are told. Is there any other questions for Joan? Don't be shy. We're going to go ahead and conclude. Hey, Dave.
How's it going?
Good, good.
Hi, Joan. Thank you very much for all that fantastic information.
Oh, thank you.
Daniel was saying that you're always looking for an audience to share this information with. Would you be interested in doing it again on Sunday?
Oh.
Doesn't have to be this week. But I do a podcast on Sunday, How to Win in Court Without a Liar, and would love to share your information with the audience there.
Sure, I cannot do it this Sunday. I have to get a motion into a court case that I'm involved in, and the deadline's Monday. And as you know, deadlines can kill you. Would I do it as long and as detailed? I mean, this was a two-hour talk here.
Well, that's my podcast goes 3 hours. Usually the first hour or so I would talk, but I'm happy to, give you the first and the second hour to share as much information as you're willing to share.
Oh, I'd be thrilled.
And it's any Sunday. I mean, you let me know. Daniel and I work together pretty close, and when you have a free Sunday, it's 5 to 8 o'clock Mountain Time. So.
Oh, that's a relief. Oh, good, because I keep crazy hours. I usually activate this cell phone and myself at around noon and go to sleep at about 5 or 6 a.m. later is better, definitely. Okay, Daniel will put us together, I'm sure.
Yes, we'll do that.
Thank you.
Well, it's an unusual night. We've actually are going to be stopping. It looks like we're going to be stopping before 9. Unless I hear any noise from the crickets out there. Like I said, it was a very extensive call. What the question would be the thing. You've really went through a pretty detailed point by point of what's going on and laid it out. So, any other questions
out
there?
Thank you. Just do remember my editorial service offer as well. I'm happy to help. Okay. All right.
Hey, everybody.
Thank you all.
I've got something to chime in with, and a couple comments and a question. This is Matthew. I'm part of Dave's study group. I got on the call a little bit late, but I was really looking forward to hearing some medical stuff. From someone that's not on YouTube. Real time talk. That's what I'm all about, but I have a personal fascination with the human body and the health of the human body. So you said a couple things that corresponded to a couple things that I'm aware of. So first, I got two comments. You made a mention of the contact tracing, and despite all this worldly stuff we got going on, you know, there's, it's an unworldly framework. And the contact tracing initiative is called House Resolution 6666, four sixes.
Right.
That's not
right.
a coincidence. So for one, and then two, a gentleman mentioned how, you know, how they like to, you know, play with words and change meanings. And they're very specific about the, what they say. And in line with that, and you made some mention, some very nice mechanical explanations to a small degree, but something I've never heard, which is talking about the logistics of the lack of oxygen that can take place within the blood, and then corresponding that to the possible 5G stuff, because that all kind of melts together on the deeper end of the, you know, quote unquote conspiracy rabbit hole. But nonetheless, it's all relevant, 100%, in my opinion. But the wordplay that I noticed, and I haven't worn a mask this whole time. I'm beyond religiously against it. I'm firmly, lifely against it. My soul is against it. For you know, reasons that are, I witness evil in front of me on a regular basis, as we all do. And the trick is being able to discern that evil. So the wordplay with the mask is that they, at first, were, they call them masks now for the most part, but they were calling them face coverings, and they were calling them masks. And those are two different things. And one of them applies to an earthly medical concept, and face coverings get into religion. And anybody can take that and look into it if they want. But there's a power, the powers that think they are, or that pretend to be, have tried to implement face coverings, which is not a medical term by any means. Masks apply to a medical terminology, but face coverings are entirely based off of religious framework, to put it loosely. So that's something I've noticed very, very intricately. They don't call them face coverings much anymore, but that's, in their eyes, they're face coverings. So that was the two comments. The question is, you know, you mentioned different things, different nutrients we can add to our body, or from a natural healing standpoint, I like to influence the body to do things that it's designed to do, because it's designed to be immune, and the immune system is called an immune system because it's supposed to achieve immunity, and immunity isn't a partial thing. Immunity is very thorough and directly shielding everything from it. So the lack of immunity comes from the body's lack of function, and our body functions from the nutrients that we take into it. So when I come into any bodily dysfunction concepts, I always look at the body as lacking something. Not that it got infiltrated, it became weak and let itself get beat up. So in that, you mentioned, you know, B12, vitamin C, and you mentioned glutathione. And glutathione, something particularly that I've got tuned into learning about a while back. And I want to ask you, you know, out of all the things you mentioned, is, you know, can you tell me anything particular about glutathione that would be more, because glutathione's potent, the liver makes it. And so glutathione is something our body makes, and there's certain things that our body has to go through a lot of processes to make or convert things, or you get into things like vitamin C. If it's not in the right form, or any vitamin, if it's not in the right form, you're not going to get as much as you think you're getting when you take, you know, that 500 or that 1,000 milligram. You're only getting a fraction of it if the quality is not proper. So as far as glutathione goes, our liver produces it and squirts it into our bloodstream as what they would you know, call the master detoxifier, or I call it the degreaser of the blood. So is there things that you're aware of that have to do with, you know, and as opposed to taking in nutrients, things that we can stimulate our body with to allow it to naturally defend itself, as opposed to, because I know that's what nutrient intake does, but when you get into something like glutathione, there's certain things out there that can influence it to be produced more in more quantity and more rapidly. So
yes.
What is your take on that?
Yes, well, you bring up an excellent thought about glutathione. It is called the master antioxidant, and it's actually an anti-aging product as well. Aging is in part just oxidation, which is like iron rusting. We rust inside from oxidation products, and glutathione corrects that. It's interesting that you bring up some precursors to glutathione, because N-acetylcysteine, which is called NAC, is a major precursor to glutathione, and taking more NAC can induce our bodies to stimulate the production of more glutathione, especially along with selenium, which is necessary for glutathione, and I think magnesium, but definitely selenium is part of the glutathione cycle. Now, wouldn't you know, the FDA is thinking about, or poised to, or actually has already, remove NAC from the market. And it's just one more amazing coincidence here. If you're thinking about getting NAC at any health food store or online, stock up while you can, because it's a very important precursor to glutathione. And there are foods that have a lot more NAC in them also, mainly your what they're called cruciferous vegetables, broccoli and cauliflower, kale, and there are several others in the cruciferous family. And there's a lot of good information online about foods that have NAC and properties of glutathione. Glutathione is an amazing product. It's anti-cancer, antiviral, antioxidant. It's just really one of God's gifts to us.
I truly agree with that, and I believe in that thoroughly. And that's out of everything that, you know, you listed, glutathione was the one thing, and I'll tell you why it's close to me as far as the knowledge of it anyways in a moment. But out of everything that you mentioned, glutathione is the one thing that I know is designed by nature. God gave it to our body. He made our body to produce it. And the glutathione, you know, is really what it is. It is a master, supreme antioxidant. It nothing really compares as far as my research goes. And this has been, I've been in researching food and nutrition, just the human health and mechanics of the body, you know, for the past decade, roughly on and off in my hobby research of things. So it's a hobby for me to learn this extracurricular stuff, because I'm just a construction guy and that's what I do. But I like to fix things. And so when you get into the body, it seems like it's the most broken thing that we're all acquainted with, whether it's ourselves or someone we know. So the glutathione is the one thing that our body actually makes on its own that is a key to a lot. And what the system has done through the food supply and the denaturing of our intake and the habits, the denaturing the habits of our intake as well as the substance that we intake, they've shut down the glutathione output to some large enough degree to where our bodies aren't defending ourselves the way they're supposed to. So I came into this knowledge through coffee enemas and Gerson therapy, which I'm sure you're aware of.
Oh, yes, sure.
So, you know, that's something that I about I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. Pretty much, you know, going on to what you said about the FDA limiting supply of things or limiting output, you know, doctors can't prescribe a coffee enema to somebody or else their license is in jeopardy. So if there's physicians with licensure from the government has in their rules that coffee enemas aren't allowed to use, basically, which was a big wake up or a big sign for me at the beginning of my research when I came into these concepts. So, but ultimately what it comes down to is, and this is just sharing with everyone listening or whoever hears this, is that, you know, to amplify the output of glutathione in your body, because your body makes it, you do need to support the things that your body has to make because it uses other materials to make it. But glutathione is something very special that the body makes no matter what. And we can amplify that with a coffee enema more than anything else I've come across. And this is coming from the standpoint of, instead of taking things into our body to add to what our body can do, we zero in on what the body already has in it and then get it to work again or amplify its process. And so what's your take on that?
Well, I think there's definitely a route to go. Anything that we can do, even just the foods that we have, you know, especially if we make a commitment to for organic, GMO, glyphosate-free food, we're much better off to out the gate just to start with, and concentrating on foods that are helpful, that have known ingredients that will naturally encourage our body to manufacture these things, especially glutathione, will be far healthier.
Joan, do you have a recommendation? Let me finish this real quick. I've been
sure.
Hanging in the... Yeah, thank you. Moderator Daniel here just got a question for people that might be listening. Is there a place that you can go and see if there's a recommended dose of, for example, NAC, to have its maximum effect? Is there, can you overdose on this and NAC, and what's your thought on that, all that?
Well, NAC, I used 600 milligrams 3 times a day on my HIV positive patients. One of the reasons that I have been looking at this so closely is because I developed a rather complete non-pharmaceutical, for the most part, virus RNA virus treatment program. So when I saw the emergence of SARS-2, I thought, well, you know, I've been here before. It's another RNA virus, and I bet I know lots of things to do for it already. And son of a gun, it's the same dynamics. But your listener is quite correct that using food and whatever it can take to push the enzymatic reactions towards naturally creating more of these marvelous substances that we produce is an excellent way to an excellent process to use.
Wow, you bring me to a point that wasn't spoken, that is in that same vein. Have you heard of chlorine dioxide?
Yes, also known as dioxychlor, not to be confused with chlorine bleach, please.
Correct. A big difference. Yeah, I've been using it for years. I've helped people with it, helped people with cancer and the like. It's considered the strongest pathogen killer known to man, and I believe it could be helped in this arena with the vaccine, especially if it's done quickly enough. I really think that should be on the table also, especially since the government reacts so strong against it and
yes,
go against
right.
people who,
right.
yeah, whatever they go against strongly, that's something you want.
yes.
And I know it works well even in my own life. So I've been doing it for practically since about 2012 or 13.
Hmm.
Helped many, many people.
And where are you getting your dioxychlor, if you don't mind me asking?
What's that again?
Where are you getting your dioxychlor, if you don't mind me asking?
I got two sources. I don't have it offhand. One is through a private membership association, and the other one is by KB LLC, which is their new name. So, yeah, it's getting harder to get, but there are still sources out there.
It's on Amazon.
If you...
Yeah, it's really expensive on Amazon, though.
Yeah, but it's there.
Yes. And I prefer not to use Amazon for something like that because of tracking. So I tend to deal with the independent distributors, especially those that are operating through a private membership association.
If you wouldn't mind, if you would communicate a little more information to Daniel so that I could talk to you separately after this about
that.
Sure,
no problem.
Okay, great.
No problem.
And Joan, man,
jump on in there.
Yeah, I use MMS as well. I've been for about 5 years. Got to be careful with it, though. Really be careful. Make sure you read the instructions and the protocols. It is nothing to play with, especially topically. Joan, you know, I'm in California, Rich, and I'm in California. About 6 years ago, I think it was, I had to have a hip replacement, so I had to have a bunch of blood work done. And I had a really low vitamin D. And I started, I mean, it was like really low. Everything, calcium and all the other things were kind of up there fairly good, but that one was really low. And I started asking all my friends, and I said, you know, do you ever get yours done? And every time they go in, you know, and I'm talking about active athletes, guys that are friends. No, I'm not an athlete, but some of my friends are. They were all low. We're in California. We're out in the sun. And, you know, this vitamin seems to have an important role in the defense of this virus and viruses. And I mean, maybe it's just my suspicion, but do you know why we may be deficient? I mean, I'm assuming we are because if a state like California with so much sun leaves people that way normally, I just question me. You know, I'm very intuitive about things for myself. And I kept saying, why is this so low, and why is everybody else reporting the same thing after year and year? And then I find out that this is one of the important vitamins to have with zinc and selenium and a few of the others that you mentioned to keep your immune system up. So do you have any knowledge about what might be causing this? Is this maybe from GMOs or glutathione? Not glutathione. What's that? Glyphosate.
You're close.
Well, yeah, I've taken too many of them. I can't speak right, you know. So do you have any clue as to where this might be coming from? Did they do this to us, I wonder? Did they set us up for this?
Well, a couple of thoughts. Number one, there has been a tremendous degradation of the quality of our food supply in terms of depleted soils. And the USDA has done a lot of research on foods, and the mineral content, especially of foods, has just declined like 75% over the past 50 years. It's just remarkable. I think personally it's to the point where maybe we can't get all the nutrients we need just from food right now. Even the organically grown foods, it's a good step back in the right direction. But, you know, we're only as good as what we eat, and we're only really as good as what we absorb from what we eat. So I have a couple of thoughts. I have recommended a minimum of 5,000 units of vitamin D3 for people, but D is absorbed much more efficiently if one takes a vitamin K supplement along with it. And there are several different subgroups of vitamin K. I believe it's K3 that helps vitamin D get absorbed much more actively. The only people who need to watch their vitamin K intake are people who are on blood thinners. Everybody else can take vitamin K with no problem. That's point one. Some people need a combination of vitamin D2 and vitamin D3. And there are some products out there that have a combination of both of them. So those are my two thoughts for you.
Well, that's a beautiful explanation there, Joan. Is there anybody else that's got a redirect to their question? Or
can I chime in on that one?
I'll do it one at a time. That's why I'm trying to watch the board here for muting.
Go ahead. I got something to chime in on the exactly what was being talked about right now.
Go ahead. I'll wait.
Okay, I appreciate it. It's directly corresponding to, so, and, you know, I want your opinion on this too, Joan, what you think, and your professional perspective, because I'm a freelance learner, and you know you've zeroed in on medical stuff, so I appreciate any opinions you have 100% as seniority and a professional in the field. If I'm not mistaken, you were talking about the sun. Yeah, I'm in sunny Southern California as well. This is something I came across a while back as far as the concept, which makes a lot of sense, but correct me if I'm wrong, Joan, do our eyes absorb vitamin C or vitamin D from the sun? Do we intake vitamin D with our eyes? Because they've trained us over generations to wear sunglasses, and that blocks out the sun from our eyes. That's crucial.
It blocks out the ultraviolet rays. The ultraviolet, this is my understanding, the ultraviolet rays hit our skin. There's A and UVA and UVC. Okay. And that stimulates our own skin cells to manufacture vitamin D. So it's not only through our eyes. The right kind of sunglasses will protect your eyes from the harmful type of ultraviolet light rays. But it's our skin that manufactures vitamin D internally.
So would you say that the prevention of UVB or UVA coming into our eyes would prevent the way that vitamin D is processed through our skin? Is that plausible as a concept?
Anything is plausible until it's disproven, and so I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's just a concept I'm throwing out there because when I'm troubleshooting, what I do is as the world evolves and technology, becomes – or attempts to be God to humanity, I look back and I see where things weren't there for a long period of time and then they just showed up. And when I look back in history, sunglasses aren't that old of a trend, but they are a trend. Mm-hmm. And they tend to use trends to set us up for some type of harmful circumstance. So that's one aspect
to
think
about.
The other thing when it comes to vitamin K, as far as I'm aware of, vitamin K2, which comes from grass, which comes from, we don't eat grass necessarily, but the meat that we consume or the animals that consume the grass take that vitamin K2 and they condense it and they put it into their products for us to consume. So when you get into that, the quality of the, upbringing of the animal is going to make the, make or break us receiving vitamin K and any variant from that natural source that we don't naturally eat. So that's where you get into raw dairy. Grass-fed dairy is known to have high amounts of vitamin K in variants, K2 especially, and as well as vitamin D and vitamin A. Are you familiar with the research of Weston A. Price?
Oh, yes, the Pottinger Price Foundation.
Well, Weston A. Price in the early 1900s basically found he was a dentist and he started noticing in the early teens, started noticing tooth decay rapidly onsetting the population. So he went around the world, literally traveled the world, and went into rural areas, populated areas, native people, hybridized, you know, cultures of those native peoples, and he corresponded the tooth decay that he was seeing, which also corresponded with, you know, lacking bone structure in the new generations, the jaw being less developed, which is where now we, you know, it's typical for us to have teeth pulled, you know, in order for our mouth to be able, our jaw to be able to fit all the teeth that we're supposed to have. This is all generation, you know, every time we modify, we each generation affects its genetics and then passes it on. So the system has used the food supply to modify our genetics, hence the term GMO. Over generations, you know, starting back in the days of when, you know, glyphosate, DDT, all of the, you know, in the 40s and the 50s when they really started to screw up agriculture with all of their poisons. And on another note from that, something I came across, anyone can look into, is that the study of virology started when they started to use all these pesticides in agriculture and plants weren't able to handle it. There's a lot of testing taking place, but they were doing it in real time. And so when they would have diseased crops, they needed something besides their poisons to blame it on. So they came up with viruses and said the plants were getting infected with viruses, which gave them a quote unquote more necessity to create more poisons to put into the plants. So they've really denatured the food supply. This is what the adversary does. It takes what's natural that the creator gave to us and does everything possible to turn it upside down. I mean, this goes all the way from our food supply to making a, you know, worship in the body on the first day of the week instead of the last. You know, the Sabbath is the last day of the week. That's the one we're told in the fourth commandment to uphold. So the enemy has this, the adversary to humanity has this pattern of flipping everything that is right and doing everything to corrupt it, because he can't create, he can only modify. So
Matthew, I do appreciate the fact that you have a lot of passion on this. This was actually Joan's show, so I'm going to ask you to just to cut it short and kind of wrap things up there so that we can get on to maybe someone that might have another question.
If you could, I appreciate it. I just wanted to throw that in there with the K2. Vitamin K2 and vitamin A and vitamin D can be obtained through fermented cod liver oil, and you can go to a company you can look into. It's called Green Pasture. They make some really high-quality supplements that are probably unheard of by many, but more useful than a lot of the basic supplements on the market. Appreciate the time, everybody. Hope the info is useful. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew. Any comments on that, Joan, as we move on?
I think Matthew said it all with very cogent and perceptive comments.
Thank you, Matthew. I appreciate everybody's participation. Is there anybody else that's chomping at the bit that was required to get some words in here before we call our meeting to an end?
Yes.
I
just want a quick comment. I read an article by a doctor a couple of days ago. I don't know where it's at right now. But his synopsis was that those people who took the Depop shot to load up on B1 as to help as a blood thinner because of the clotting. And the clotting, like Joan mentioned earlier, is in all of them, all four of them. So, and he did a lot of testing along with a lot of other doctors with regard to detection, pre-detection of clotting, and all of them show those propensities to clog the blood. So he said B1, thiazine or something like that, would help with that regard. So I've been telling people who I've been working with, if they know people who have taken it, at least do that until we learn more, because it's definitely clotting and it's affecting multitude of issues in the body. It's not just one thing. It can attack the brain. You can get the inflammation based on influenza. All kinds of things are happening because of this. So I just want to end with that.
Well, I would like to comment back. The critical frontline critical COVID critical care alliance was formed by a number of physicians who specialize in ICU management, and they're called intensivists because they all their patients are in an intensive care unit. So they're pretty far along with their COVID severity if they're that sick. And they've developed several protocols, and the first one they worked on was called the MATH protocol, and it's MATH. It's another acronym. It stands for, the M is methylprednisolone, which is a steroid. The A is ascorbic acid, although I would prefer the ascorbate form. The T in the MATH protocol is thiamine, which is B1. So they're administering all of this intravenously through a vein directly, and then the H is heparin as a blood thinner to combat the clotting. So, and I personally would expand it to all the B vitamins because they all work in tandem and in concert together, especially B12. But I found it fascinating that these very traditional doctors stumbled onto the use of thiamine or B1 as part of an intensive management for people who are very sick with COVID. And they've had just remarkable results with their protocol.
Yeah. This doctor in particular, he was targeting people who just recently got it, not those that were sick. So it seems like the approach would be good on both sides, as you mentioned, with regards to those that were acutely sick and seem to come back a little upon the therapy. That's
okay.
All for me.
Joan, you have been such a blessing to us tonight. Did you want to leave us with any final thoughts as we wrap up the House of Prayer meeting tonight? You know what? Try that again.
We might have lost her.
No, we didn't lose her. Joan, are you there?
Yes, yes. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Final thoughts of the night.
Yes. I think, as you've seen from my talk, we are at an unprecedented and tremendous crossroads, personally and for our entire nation. So I would just encourage you, silence is consent to what's happening.
Amen.
And the time for silence is over. So that's my final thought. Please, if you have the chance to act, do so. It was, I've done four times of public speaking, and yet it was still unnerving for me to go in front of the assembly. And I just did it, and doing makes it easier the next time you're doing it. So if I can do it, anyone can do it. So please get started. We have a window of opportunity to tremendously affect our health and our nation for the better. And I encourage and implore really all of us to take advantage of it.
Beautiful way to end your beautiful talk, Joan. Thank you so much for your time. All of us here at the House of Prayer appreciate what you put together for us tonight. It's everybody share this call with everybody that you know, and let's get it out there. Let's get the word out, and we can rebroadcast this. I'll get you a copy of this recording tomorrow so that you can share it as well, Joan. Thank you so much.
Great. All righty. My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you, Daniel.
Yes.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody. Bless everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.